memorandum was handed over by civil society groups calling for the urgent finalization of this bill. When just before we close today's meeting, I'm going to address certain issues raised in this memorandum, which you sought to address at the start of this meeting, but just in case they were missed, I just thought I'd say that to you. All right, Mr. Bassett.
And I'm going to hand over to Engela, but just to conclude that debate, if I get a sense the committee said clause 30A can come out, that would mean, as far as definitions are concerned, instrumentality of an offence on page 8, proceeds of unlawful activities also on page 8, trafficking related activities, definition of trafficking related activities on page 10, an unlawful activity on page 11, they will all come out because they're all linked, they're only linked to that provision, clause 30A.
Agreed?
Yeah.
Alright,
and I'll hand over to Engela, thank you.
Yes. Where are we, Mr. Ambrosin?
On 32, the
page where?
9.
Right.
If you would.
Yes.
And this is a concern I've expressed on several occasions about having as objective as possible, the text which are as objective as possible. We have eliminated from the definition of vulnerability and abuse of vulnerability the psychological or physical, the word psychological or physical, and we just look at abuse and we know its forms. Here we have perceived threats. I mean, a threat is always a combination of something objective and subjective. But by having threats or perceived threats, one creates the one that is a combination of objective and subjective, and the second one which is purely subjective. And I think that that becomes too complicated. We don't want legislation which gives recognition to something which could be purely subjective, to the point of not being part of a shared reality. I would leave it just through traits of harm.
The Honourable Debbie Schaefer.
So, Chair, I don't agree with that. I mean, very often people are kept in those kind of states because they are threatened, and then they are kept in a state that they still perceive that threat to exist, even if it doesn't, because of the circumstances in which they are, you know, find themselves. So I don't think we can remove perceived threat because, I mean, it may be real, but it's not necessarily immediate. So, you know, people might feel that if they do some, if they leave, then they will be whatever, killed or whatever. I mean, it's not necessarily an immediate threat of harm. It doesn't say immediate, I know, but I think that's how it may well be interpreted. I'd like to hear Mr. Bassett on that, perhaps. But I think very often the perceptions are what keeps the people in that condition.
Advocate Holomis.
Chair, I myself have some difficulties indeed with the perceived threats of harm. And I'm wondering if there are other laws where we have this kind of provision. Perceived threat of harm is subjective. I know that there would be instances where even the element of subjectivity has to be taken into account, but I'm just having the same difficulties as Dr. Ambrosini has with this threat of perceived threat. Might be open to abuse.
Williams.
Sorry, Chair, I can't get to it now, but I remember when drafting this, it was taken from
It was used. I'm not sure if it was a protocol or similar legislation where they used this, I perceive this, but I can't get to it now, but we can come back to that. I can read.
If I may, Chair.
Yes.
You see, here, we are trying to deal with a rather difficult, dicey situation where we're even giving more rights than we give to other victims of crime.
There you go.
So we therefore need to be careful not to open it too wide in order for people to abuse the environment that we're creating to deal with the problems of victims of trafficking.
Okay. The Honourable Jeffrey.
Following on from that, Ms. Williams speaks about Palermo, but Palermo is I can't find perceived threats. It's under the definition on page 101 of the version of the bill. Trafficking, etc., means whatever, by means of the threat or use of force or other forms of coercion. Okay. Which is then different to threat of or perceived threat. And again, it's this question, and remember, this deals with labor trafficking. So, do you want, the fear would be that you want that it ends up so wide, and once you're in the traffic victim category, you're entitled to a whole lot of resources and attention. How does one measure a perceived threat? That's not even objective, is it? It would be a subjective test. So what I would want to suggest is, following on from Nkosi Olumisa and Ms. Tambusini, would it help if one followed the wording of Palermo and referred to coercion? Is that better? But can we also, and this is what I'd really want, is can we get a comparison of the other laws, international, as to what they are using as far as this? But I agree with the concern that the way it's phrased at the moment may just be too wide.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that sounds better. The coercion, I think, sounds better. It might reduce the risk of the subjectiveness, but still keep that other. That it's not necessarily as direct. Yeah.
But can we look at particularly the more recent
acts? I'm not sure what Kenya says, because they've, I think, got the latest one.
Didn't you get this?
That's only on the sentences.
Oh, that's only on sentences.
Yeah, it's not on this aspect.
Okay.
And in Kenya, they put their refugees in camps, which is not something we do, and so also maybe a comparison with a more developed country that doesn't place its refugees in camps. I'm just sort of approaching it from the point of view of abuse of the provision.
Right. I'm curious to know what the USA does, because this memorandum we've received pointedly refers to the U.S. State Department's report. Are victims of trafficking welcomed into America? Open arms? Given jobs and benefits? You're obviously not in position to respond now. Need to have a look at it. Just to, I think I share the concerns. But servitude is really used. It's not used in the definition of trafficking per se. It's a part of the definition of exploitation. It's the only place it comes across in the bill. But anyway, we'll have a look at that.
Yes, Honourable Deshaver.
But slavery is one of the essential conditions of slavery, any or all of the powers that technically lie in the body. And then that is the United States.
Can you please repeat that using another mic?
Can you hear me now? Yeah. I've got the Kenya document that we were given before by the department, and there's a definition of slavery only, not servitude, and that's the closest thing that could be similar as far as I can see. And it just says the status or condition of a person over whom any or all of the powers attaching to the right of ownership are exercised, but it doesn't mention threats particularly.
Can we have a look at that, bearing in mind the consequence? We might be useful to go back to the Law Reform Commission. As well, to see how they addressed it, and I'm trying to think back, but it was a long time ago why that was put in the first place.
Page 11 of this document, there's still the definition then of the UN protocol that I gather must come out. Excuse me. Coming to the clause.
Why did it come out? It's referred to in the bill. It needs to stay there for clarity, the definition. Okay, what comes out is the English text of which is replicated in Schedule 2. So surely you're not removing the definition, you're just removing the English text as replicated in Schedule 2.
Okay.
And it is referred to in the bill, isn't it, or not?
I think it's referred to, well, it was in the bill as introduced, but that's in the objects clause.
Obviously, if it's not referred to anywhere, then it comes out. Yeah. But if it is referred to, it does need to be defined. Although, as we've said, it doesn't stay in the text. Doesn't stay in the bill. Yeah.
In the long definition,
we've taken it out in the long title, and I'm just having a look. We do mention it. We do mention it in the preamble. It hasn't been taken out there. But we've taken it out in the long title, so just a quick glance, I think the only place you might find it in the bill now is in the preamble.
So it's the preamble and it doesn't need to be defined.
So it comes out?
Yeah.
All right.
Saving paper.
Moving to clause 2 of the bill. On page 11, the interpretation of certain expressions, there's a footnote 20. On 6 September, the committee indicated it would like to flag this provision, particularly insofar as it relates to Ukutuala.
Too sure. We try to remember, we made notes of that, and we're trying to discuss what the connection to Ukutuala was. I think I know there were discussions on Ukutuala when it came to the penalties, but I'm not too sure.
Mr. Jeffrey, then Schaefer, then...
Yeah, I was very surprised to read that footnote. I thought the interpretation was a question of comparisons with other legislation. And then how it impacted on the mens rea component of other provisions in the bill, the mental element. I mean,
because you know for a crime you've got to intend to commit the crime, and this deals with that. So I thought that was the issue we were flagging with this, was I think the report we got was that it was in other legislation, so it's covered. I think one of them, Chair, was state information, although I can't remember. But it was that, and then how it impacted on the intention element of certain of the crimes that we're creating.
Mr. Noel came, he handed documentation out, and he spoke to this, what Mr. Jeff is talking about, on a previous occasion. I got a sense, when we left here on the 6th, that the committee had sort of accepted this provision more or less. So, and as I say, I made notes when we were here on the 6th, and I've got flag Ukutwala, and I think my colleagues had that as well, and I should have written more detail down, but I think this clause is more or less settled as a result of the discussions that took place last time.
Of course, he mentioned to me that he will rearrange his schedule for the next few weeks so that he can stay and attend to this this issue as it relates to a traditional matter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure whether my point relates to this clause or to the impact of this clause on the rest of the bill. I'm not sure whether requires changing to the clause, but possibly changing to the rest of the bill. What this clause does puts two things under one definition: the actual knowledge, which is A, and the imputed knowledge, or constructive knowledge, which is B, and calls A and B knowledge. I'm fine with that. But then you go through the bill and you find three things. Knowledge, which in terms of these two is the actual knowledge and the imputed or constructive knowledge. Then you find another thing, which is should have known. But since we put constructive knowledge and imputed knowledge under the definition of knowledge, this should have known remains out there as an additional element which should not be there, because then its knowledge is already inclusive of imputed and constructive knowledge. And then there is a third thing which I'm very concerned about, echoing some of the debates Mr. Chairman, the three of us have had in the secrecy bill. And the third thing is a should have suspected. Suspected or should have suspected. So one accepts that this is an hideous crime, but we are imposing on the citizen the duties to suspect other citizens. And that ties with subsection 2, where the standard legal test of reasonable conduct is moved two steps forward, where it becomes reasonable diligence and vigilance. The combination of these imposes an active duty on people to suspect and investigate others, more suitable to a Soviet country than to a democratic one. So my suggestion, if we keep sub-clause 1 as it is, then should have known must come out, because it's covered by this in the rest of the bill, and suspected should surely come out, because one cannot impose an obligation on the citizen to suspect and sending them to jail for failure to suspect. And 2 also needs to be reconsidered, because you cannot have the reasonable to have known or suspected, a suspected needs to go out. In fact, if the conclusion that he or she ought to have reached are those which would have been reached by a reasonable person, diligent and vigilant must come out. And then and I think that will bring it in standard with other legislation without pushing beyond what democratic practices are accustomed to.
First, the Honourable Debbie Schaefer, then Steve Swart, and then Mr. Jeffrey.
Can we
we've got to have, I mean, we've got to allow for reasonable conditions. And I mean, I don't see how the problem is the way it is. We've agreed on this long ago now. And I mean,
you've got to protect people. You can't allow people to say, oh, but how would I have known, you know, on what basis? I mean, there are many circumstances, and if they're not reasonable, then they should be liable.
Point of order.
I hope you're not jumping the queue. Let me hear the point of order.
It was just that it's echoing what DA and ACDP are saying. We did discuss this extensively. I think from a point of order, we should not entertain it. Dr. Ambrosini was not here. We had the NPA, we had submissions, we had a whole lot of stuff. So I really want to suggest that you rule that the discussion is out of order. So that's trying to help preempt, and then also from Mr. Swati.
Yeah, I'm in support of that. We're under pressure to finalize it. And I think your request for Mr. Bassett was only dealing with the issues that we referred to. So let's limit that. Otherwise, we're going to go through every possible clause again.
All right.
We did have a discussion on it, yes, but you're right, it was only the penalties that was the issue. We had the meeting before, and we agreed all around that the defiler and property tax people were not for filing. And it was a penalty given the idea.
And we
settled
the penalty provision, in fact, but that's the abuse of a quitwala, because a quitwala is not covered by the bill, it remains legal, properly done. But where this forced marriage that wasn't we dealt with it in the we also settled it in the penalty section. Yeah.
All right.
Chair,
Mr. Swartz
pointed out you haven't made a ruling on the point of order.
Well, address on the point of order before you rule, Mr. Chairman. You see, we're all here trying to make contributions. If the privilege of having a mind is that you can change it. So if something has been discussed, I accept it has been discussed in my absence, but the point remains, and it appeals to those who have recognition of the merit, will see recognition of the merits. I don't see why it should not be discussed. If the committee doesn't want to discuss a point, it doesn't discuss it. But not merely because it was discussed before, it shouldn't be discussed.
All right, let's do this, Mr. Ambrosini. We had agreed at the beginning of this meeting that Mr. Bassett and his team would take us through those issues we had flagged. It wasn't issues they were raising, but issues we ourselves as a committee had flagged, and we had agreed to that. Now, at some stage down the line, you will be in a position to raise the issues that you are trying to raise now. So let's proceed along those lines. Please, Mr. Bassett. So my ruling is that that is how we will proceed.
Thank you, Chair. On page 12 of the document, clause 3, objects of the Act, we'll see footnote 21 states that the portfolio committee decided to take a decision on this clause at a later stage.
All right.
Why? I mean, it actually looks fine.
Well, you decided.
on the section, it looks fine. So was it not the detail of the wording? I mean, often we deal with the objects right at the end. But I think you could remove the footnote. When we go through the bill, we can, or maybe you can just alert us right at the end. But it seems fine to me for now.
I think it was to see what the bill looks like once it's been. Virtually when the committee is ready to vote on it and to see whether it covers everything, whether the objects clause covers everything that is eventually in the bill. That was the reasoning behind it. It wasn't about the wording. So do you want your footnote to come out or leave it there? Take it out? Okay. Fine. Footnote comes out, Mr. Bassett.
If you can proceed to page 14 of the document.
Your footnote 4 created.
22.
Yes, you haven't addressed us on that.
And I was just thinking, who commits? You see, there's an issue of the verb. I mean, it's proposed that we wanted, or the drafters, that's you, not us, commit offences under this Act. It sounds fine, but just a quick one of created does not, I can see the problem with created. If you have referred to.
Yeah, that's better, actually. That's what you normally use, eh? Referred to. It's 3B. Okay, Mr. Bassett. So that footnote can also come out. Great.
On page 14 of the document, footnote 24, we have taken out the words the directly or indirectly there, and it was inserted in paragraphs I and J, as was suggested by this committee. And then again on the same page, page 14, footnote 27, again deals with the words immediate family member.
We take footnote 28 out. I think it's been settled. If I may just talk about it, it'll give me, Mr. Chair, an idea of what on the way forward. Can we start removing the footnotes then as we go along?
Yes.
For instance, footnote 28, which I don't think we will talk about because that was dealt with in a previous question.
Right. So 28 can come out. Honourable members?
Yeah, fine.
Well, footnote 23? That comes out, okay. 24?
Yeah, the rest I think is fine.
When you say it's fine, are you saying they all come out?
27?
Mr. Jeffrey?
It just going back to the issue of the servitude and the debate we had earlier, because this is where it all hangs together. And it's just pointing out that you know, this is the nub of the trafficking crime, and it's threat of harm and all those things which are quite obvious, and it is for the purpose of any formal manner of exploitation. Exploitation then includes servitude, and then servitude is the perceived threat. So really, I don't think the perceived threats that we dealt with earlier are needed. Because the nub of the crime is it's you use your force, your coercion through A to J, okay, which are all direct material objective factors. Okay. So the fact that you were in a servitude through a perceived threat doesn't really have any place, because a servitude is defined as a form of exploitation. I don't know if I'm making sense.
I raised that just now as well. I said the definition of servitude only really appears in once in the bill, and that's in the definition of exploitation.
Do we need servitude as exploitation? I mean, remember the thing is it's broader, includes but not limited. But then if we have servitude, which is a condition in which the labor of services are obtained through threats of harm to that person. I'm just, it's
my concern is almost that you've got two mental elements for trafficking.
I don't feel strongly about it. The protocol says, going back to page 101, Article 3, use of terms, it tells you what trafficking is, and trafficking is all that for the purpose of exploitation, and then it goes on to say exploitation shall include at a minimum the exploitation of the prostitution or of others or other forms of sexual exploitation, forced labor, services, slavery, or practices similar to slavery, servitude, or the removal of organs. So servitude is mentioned there, but
if it's mentioned, fine.
Yeah.
But just take out. It's more the point I was wanting. Why I was raising it was to conclude the argument earlier around surely the perceived threats in servitude are not necessary in the definition. I don't know, Chair, if they're in agreement. They all seem to be looking down. And
No, I
could then say you're in agreement.
Sorry.
Okay.
Yes, that's
all right. So does that mean we've dealt with footnote 27? We've agreed 28 comes out.
Might be useful, I don't know, like the guidance of the committee to keep 29, because that gives you an idea of where those provisions have gone to, if you want to have a look.
Okay.
Yeah, that stays there for those references. Okay, fair enough. All right. 30?
On page 15 of the document, footnote 30, you will find it there at the offence of debt bondage, any person intentionally engages in conduct, and the committee decided to keep the word intentionally wherever it appears in the offences in this chapter. So we have left it there.
Agreed.
So that footnote can come out.
Page 16, the footnotes refer to there is to bring those clauses in line with clause 2 to provide that for a person to know, suspect, or ought reasonably to have known or suspected. So you will find it there in clause 7 and as well as in clause 8 8.1 A and C.
Okay.
Going on to page 17.
Wait a minute. Are we okay with that? So those footnotes can come out?
Your guidance in respect of the previous ruling, now that it comes under a footnote, can I address on the issue, should I wait until I have another opportunity?
Doing something else.
No, it's this, it's footnote 30.
34, right.
And 32. And 31.
Right. Yes.
May I address you?
Please.
Yes. You see, these three insertions create three categories: known, should have known, or suspected. Known, because of the definition of section clause 2, includes already should have known, includes already imputed and constructive knowledge. So you've got should have known, which is covered under 2 and must mean something different, and I wouldn't know what it means. And on top of that, suspected, which I think ought not to be there.
Honourable members, I suspect we've covered this ground already.
Okay.
No. I don't decide, Mr. Ambrosini, but yes, the committee has the power. Ms. Schaefer, followed by Mr. Jeffrey.
Yeah, I don't see why. I don't see how this is the same as married to the canon, and I also don't agree that we should delete it. Because if somebody reasonably suspects, then they should be held responsible.
Mr. Jeffrey.
Mine is, a question over, seeing we have defined no as actual knowledge, or the court being satisfied that the person believes there's a reasonable possibility of the existence of the fact, and they failed to obtain, this is now on clause 2, page 11, the person failed to obtain information to confirm that existence. So they that which is really suspect, shouldn't we just be referring with the mental element of the crime simply to knows? So I'm not sure when you say the clause is brought in line with clause 2, but surely clause 2 gives you a definition of know and knowing, which means that you then don't have to go through suspects or ought reasonably to have known or suspected. So is it not? What's the difference between ought reasonably to have known and suspected, when in the definition of know on in clause 2, page 11, actual knowledge, okay, that's know. B, the court is satisfied that the person believes there's a reasonable possibility of the existence of the fact, and you don't check up whether it is there or not. Is that not the same as suspected? Maybe suspect is more narrow, but I mean, you're not going to... with your suspect here, there's no duty to check, because you haven't defined suspect. So so in clause 2, for knowledge, you've got to actually think there's a possibility and check it out. Whereas in the mens rea aspect of the bill, it is just suspect. You don't have to check it out. What's the point then of having this broader definition of no? So it's more radical, I suppose, but it's more saying that actually have you, in terms of the footnotes you've got of bringing it in line with clause 2, have you done it? Surely, to bring it in line with clause 2, you just refer to no. And I think, sorry for going on maybe a bit much, but are you not creating confusion by this wording? Because you've got the definition of no, then you've shoved in suspect, and the court then says, when it's trying to determine guilt, that this person may not have known, because but they did suspect, so we'll nail them on that, whereas no is surely sufficient.
So what's a strong view from the MPA, because this whole discussion was around the MPA's request for facilitation of prosecution, and they gave us this whole empty document on mens rea, that element, and I think it was as a result of that they requested the insertion of the words suspected, but it does seem a duplication, and maybe we can just get clarity from
yeah.
that.
MPA, yeah. I hear what is being said, and we might need to revisit it. The wording in clause 2, if I remember correctly, came out the corruption, anti-corruption legislation. And perhaps as part of, if we go back to revisit this, which I think we'll have to do, is to see how the corruption legislation also deals with it, where they have this sort of definition clause, and then how they deal with it in the body of the legislation. But
Yes. What we want to know is whether we need the additional suspect.
I gather that.
Because there's already a reference.
Yeah.
And it's a direct quote from Poker. Our clause 2 follows Poker. So the question is not to change clause 2, but to look at whether it's necessary
to
put the insertion of suspects in the clause 2.
To be.
So then also, if we accept that, then we also need to look again at 2.2, because, I mean, then saying a person also can be two have known all suspected, so that doesn't need to be brought in line.
The point is, if you've got suspected already there, then you don't have to have it in the next clause.
No, you don't need it, because the, my concern is that it's suspected is not included in 1.1.1. They're just saying the person believes there's a reasonable possibility. They don't refer to suspected. So I don't know whether if we do have to have suspected, we shouldn't. Included in
2.1. No, that's not the word of poker. Poker, that's the wording. It only is in the subsection.
Mr. Jeffrey?
No, I agree with Mr. Swart. I mean, I think clause 2 we've agreed to, and that was at the request of the NPA. Okay? And I don't think we need to change clause 2. It's a question of having agreed to clause 2, what other components are of the of the mens rea, the mental, the intention element are necessary. And suspect is a bit is much broader than clause 2, the definition of knowing. But will, because for knowing you've got to have suspected and taken, as far as, yeah, you've got to have suspected and then take steps to check it out. Yes, but anyway, yeah, but it's a question of yeah, okay, if it's in, but Chair, I think the bottom line is I don't know if the footnote is correct where they say clause brought in line with clause 2. We want clause 2, we like clause 2, but I don't think you've properly brought it in line.
All right, Mr. Best.
And then remembering also the issue of in order to establish a crime, I don't think a court is going to go with a vague suspicion. That's why two is so tight, and that you have to have there's a duty on you to check it out. Mm. So you get charged with leasing property for it's going to be used by traffickers, and you may be, you know, have this vague idea that it could have been a possibility, which is a suspecting, but is that enough to actually comply with the mens rea element for a crime?
To go back to all the crimes then, on that aspect, we'll do that.
All right, ma'am. And then you, Mr. Emerson.
I'm just thinking from technical perspective, it sounds sound to say that a suspect is a little bit of an iffy element to put in. But looking at the chapter, it's prevention and combating, meaning that you are placing responsibility on various categories of people to go an extra mile. So if you're leasing, we are really placing an obligation on that person to go further than just suspect. So you will suspect, and therefore we would say that from combating a perspective, you should actually take an additional step. So I'm not too sure. I'm just suspecting that for me it makes sense that we actually keep that element, because it burdens us as the public to be more attuned and be proactive in terms of, you know, our suspicion.
Yeah, I mean we're creating a crime. Mm. So this is not part of the prevention or combating aspect. It's a crime that we're creating. It's a crime to you know, use services of victims of trafficking. So it has to be certain. I mean, if you take the issue of leasing property to traffickers, maybe then if one wants to do what is being suggested, it would be better to put a duty on not create a crime, but to put a duty on people letting property. To check, but that's different to what is happening here, which is creating a crime.
And I think my view would still stand that is no does no with clause 2 not cover everything.
Mr. Ambrosini?
Yeah,
I agree with the Honourable Jeffrey. And I think that...
You're not sick when you say...
Yeah. You know, it's... even a broken clock is right twice a day.
So, well, but it's a digital clock. It's only broken right once a day.
Okay, but the fact is that clause 2 has been imported from anti-corruption legislation. The field of corruption is different because there you are dealing with public officials which can be tasked with a special obligation as part of their duties and functions to prevent and combat corruption. This bill is about the state preventing and combating trafficking. Neither in this piece of legislation nor in any other piece of legislation, no matter how hideous the crime is, can we or should we impose on the citizen the duty to become a policeman and conduct investigation on other citizens. That's again, it's how communist countries work. And we cannot send to jail as citizens merely because it failed to conduct a private investigation. It failed to suspect. It suspected, but it not acted. The should have known is standard. The vigilance, the suspicion, fits the field of corruption and the duties of public officials. It doesn't fit the activities of people who lease houses or do other trade and commerce, because it could apply to anything. It could apply to the provision of food. It could apply to the provision of equipment. Because the aid and abating clause relates to any type of assistance given within the commission of a trafficking crime.
Mr. Sloan? Chair Crispley, we should ask Mr. Bassett to approach the MPA and ask them why they want the insertion of the word suspected in the clause we're dealing with. We've agreed, clause 2, on the submission of the MPA, that it's in line with POCA, and the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act. That is settled. It's purely those words suspected. Yeah, how strong they feel about that. And that's the crisp issue, Chair.
And why suspected is included in field 2-2?
That's included exactly. It's included. That's the motivation that they gave us at length. And we agreed to follow the wording of POCA and the Prevention of Corrupt Activities Act. That's the wording that's followed in the previous legislation. We don't know whether there's been jurisprudence on the issue. You see, that's the...
Are we reopening the whole issue?
Once suspected in that clause, then why are we keeping it in 2-2?
I'm not getting hearing your questions all the time.
Can you hear it now? Here. Yeah. Why is suspected used then in 2-2, which we've agreed on? But there's now an issue that suspected can't be used in the other clause. And perhaps if you can also raise that with the NPA. I mean, I don't accept that it's because it was used in poker. Well, so what? Why was it used in poker? And then why do we now have a problem with it being in one clause but not another clause?
My concern is we're reopening issues. There's a lengthy document that deals with the deeming provisions and the mens rea, and that was on that basis of that decision we agreed to insert that wording in clause 2. We agreed to settle it. Now are we reopening the issue again and we're going to spend more hours on it? I think it's unnecessary. I really do, because obviously we debated it at the time and they gave us an explanation and we agreed to insert the words and follow the wording of the previous act. Of those acts.
And those reasons still apply.
Those reasons still apply. The MPA were here for days on end, and now are we going to go back on every possible issue and say, well, come back and explain to us again?
Was Mr. Ambrosini present? Do you know?
Well, I don't, but I know Mr. Schaefer was present.
Right. Trying to be thorough.
Well, we want to finalise this legislation at some stage.
Thank you.
audience is gone? Did you say the audience is gone? Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was more raising Mr. Naidu's gone, so the issue you wanted to address.
I'm going to address it anyway. I'm going to address it because I want it placed on record. This has nothing to do with you. Sorry.
On page 17 of the document, footnote 35.
So, what is our position on the footnotes on page 16? Do they stay there or do they come?
Can they look at it again?
Can they look at it? Alright, so they stay there and they look at it.
I'm actually, unfortunately, coming round to just leaving it as it is, as they've tabled it, but because I suspect, I mean, I see that the definition of clause 2 includes ought reasonably to have known and suspects. So maybe I would then assume in the other legislation that they do still refer to ought reasonably known and suspected. Mm-hmm. And if it has been followed, then if that is what is being done in the other legislation, that they use this broad definition of knowing, yeah, they use this definition of knowing, and then do they refer when they create crimes in the body of the legislation to ought reasonably to have known and suspected? Then if they've got that, then well, we're just doing the same.
Can they just check?
All right.
On page 17 of the document, the word controls. The committee decided on 6th of September that it was not necessary to define control, so it will just stay there. And I then suggest that we can take out a footnote.
Honourable members, we agreed.
Yeah, I think I was raising the problem around what is control, but I presume footnote 35 relates to me losing the committee, and I suppose I accept that.
Alright, so 35 comes out.
Still on page 17, clause 9.
Yes.
Before we get to 9, there should have been a footnote. I don't know, because first I missed the meeting and my point was not carried in respect of sub 2, which I had problems with.
Well, it didn't carry. Your point didn't carry.
My recollection and my notes on the point is that it was said it would be discussed later, unless it's a euphemism for not carrying it. I take things. No, I tend to take things at face value, especially when they come from you, Mr. Chairman.
My recollection is that we did, in Dr. Ambrosini's absence, discuss the thing further on the internet. And that therefore it was dealt with by the committee. He unfortunately wasn't here.
Yes,
sure.
I won't go. Well, PNG is there at the back somewhere. I'm sure they'll accommodate you.
May I have an opportunity of addressing you on this at a later stage, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, at a later stage, certainly.
Thank you.
Yeah, can we suggest that that is a private meeting not involving the committee, so we don't have to...
No, at some stage you yourself pointed out that in the process we will go through the bill again.
No, that's when I don't want to do it.
Oh, okay, well. All right. Ma'am.
There is a footnote 36, as requested by the committee on 6 September. The word which was deleted and replaced by the word who. So
agreed.
That covers
only 7
and
39
as well.
Yes.
So that footnote 36 comes out.
Yes.
Thank you.
That's correct. On page 18. We have just changed the word which with will.
Just on page 18, I think there's a subsection 5 should be subsection 4, subclause 5 should be subclause 4.
Ah, yes, thank you for that. All right, these things happen. But 37, 38, and 39...
Don't do it again.
37, 38, and 39, footnotes removed, okay? Good.
In clause 10, involvement in offences under this chapter, the words attempts to commit were inserted in paragraph A. That was as per the request of the committee on 6 September. Mm-hmm. You will also...
Sorry, clause 40, what's happening with that?
Yes.
That's agreed to. No, there's a thing that's clause 9-1 now.
Oh, yes.
That four will mean that a carrier who knowingly transports a victim enters the Republic because of circumstances. That would be the plane landing during an emergency landing.
That's correct. I'm sorry that I've forgot to mention this. The problem that we have there is if a carrier knows that he's transporting a victim of trafficking, and for some or other reason he has to enter the Republic, it seems that clause 4 is now saying that it is then not an offence.
Okay, the clause 4 is coming out, so the plane with the trafficked people that has to fly into Maseru and has to land because of problems in Joburg.
It's an offence. Yes.
Yes.
So I think that can...
So 40 can come out.
And we stick with the deletion then of the old clause 4. They are guilty.
Is it there?
Yes. So basically, if we kept 4 in that's deleted, it's 2-4, the old 2, not guilty of an offence if the entry of the victim of trafficking occurred because of circumstances beyond the control of the trafficker.
That of the carrier.
The carrier. That is the case that the aeroplane carrying the trafficked victims from Maputo to Maseru, and they then have to find a system where they then, through circumstances beyond their control, have to land in Joburg. With existing clause 4, 2-4, they nothing can be done. We're deleting it, so they then can be jumped on when they land it.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You still raise the defence of common law of necessity.
What?
No, but this is it's the issue of the entry into the Republic
with trafficked persons
beyond their control.
Yes.
So we say if there's an act of God, and sorry to, it is I think an appropriate term to use in this sense, that forces the plane down into South Africa, when you're actually trying to get the trafficked victims into another country, you're going to get arrested.
Yes.
With clause 4, and it was in there.
We're giving them a defence. Yes.
You could escape. And I don't think that was correct. Mm-hmm. So I'm supporting the text as it is before us, with clause 4 deleted, and you can then, I'm suggesting, remove the footnote. Steve, you can mute you agree.
Just got on this, but an airline that innocent...
No, that's not a traffic witness,
Steve. No, remember, it's the entry, Steve. It was the entry of the victims into the Republic. They're still victims.
Yeah.
So it's not that you didn't know they were traffic victims, it's that you didn't mean to come in to bring them into the country.
Yeah.
They did not come in here.
Did they come here and they did come?
Seems
right to them. And that, I mean, think about it, but let's leave it for now, Steve, and put notice. But that literally, Steve, I think, is an act of God of you're being trafficked to a country that doesn't recognize trafficking as a crime, and you unfortunately have to land because of weather or engine failure in South Africa, and then you can get jumped on.
So what about the trapping? What about the carrier that does not... You're assuming there's an obligation now on a carrier that is innocently transported
elsewhere, that's covered elsewhere.
That only refers to subsection 1, and subsection 1 is where you're going.
Okay. No, that's fine. And remember that no is clause 2, and also all reasonably to have no. I suspect it's not there.
Okay.
In fact, an instigator.
What's the difference between incites and instigates?
Where are you now, Dr. Ambrosini?
10-1B.
10-1B. Wait, before we go there, 41, footnote 41.
They say that's covered.
Yes, but are we taking footnote 41 out? No. Right? So it comes out. Footnote 42.
Yeah, I just hope with us removing all these footnotes to help us explain that we don't come back next time and say, why is 5B?
Keep our previous
body. No,
Yeah, very true. All right. So 41, footnote 41 comes out.
Yeah, this is not a committee for people who have got early Alzheimer's.
Yes, and I'm afraid I'm getting there myself, actually. And 42, footnote 42, comes out good. Footnote 43.
So, with regard to footnote 43, the words "an offence under this chapter" is, well, they are actually duplicated just below paragraph C.
Okay. Alright, so footnote 43 then comes out. Good. Mr. Ambrosini?
No, just instigate.
Okay. Alright. All right, page 19. Footnote 44.
That should stay because that does give an indication where they come from.
Okay. That's just for, it's an explanatory footnote.
Yes.
So that can stay there. Okay, right. Page 20. Nothing. 21.
Sir, I have a problem reading 12.1b. Should I give it to you now or at a later time?
Later
time.
Page 21, Mr. Stein.
Can I come in here? And these are the penalties. We haven't made any changes to the penalty clause because the committee asked us to have a look at the penalties or rethink them. And that's one of the documents that we made available. I'm sorry you never got it yesterday, but it was duplicated this morning. I wonder if Ms. Stone can go through the first portion, if I remember correctly. I think having a look at what the document that the NPA gave us with penalty clauses and comparisons from other countries, I think our prison sentences are in line more or less to a large degree with what the position is in other countries, but our fines are possibly way out of sync with what the situation is in other countries. I don't know whether perhaps let me just complete my part of the story and Engela can talk about the other countries. When we were going through this, when we were thinking about it, we didn't only have a look at the fines, but we had a look at the sentences of imprisonment. And let me just use an example. If you go to page 14 of the document, we set out there the headings are what the current prison term is in the bill, what the current fine is in the bill, and that current fine of 3 million, we're talking about, let's talk about clause 15 and 16, clauses 15 and 16. Currently in the bill, a person who fails to report a victim of trafficking, either a child or an adult, is liable to a one-year term of imprisonment, and the NPA proposed 3 million rand, and then the offence is what I've already said. But if you go to the comments column, and this is where I'm picking up a discrepancy, if you have a look at the Sexual Offences Act, a person who fails to report knowledge of a sexual offence, and here it is only against a child or a mentally disabled person, can be sentenced to a fine or 5 years imprisonment. It's even worse in the well, not worse, but the sentence is even higher in the Children's Act. A person who fails to report knowledge or suspicion of abuse of a child is liable to a fine or 10 years imprisonment. Now I'm raising the question, if we're having a look at the penalties overall, not only the fines, mm-hmm. shouldn't our sentence prison sentences also be more in line with what we know to be the case in other legislation, for instance in the Children's Act, in the Sexual Offences Act? Failure to reporting is subject to a 5-year or 10-year. My question is, shouldn't we be thinking to keep it in line with what is already on the on our statute book, that the prison sentence should be 5 years at least? And those are the sort of questions that we've raised for clauses 15 and 16. And in failure of a carrier to report a suspicion of a crime, there the term of imprisonment is also 1 year or 3 million rand. Section 8 of POCA provides that a person who carries on a business and who fails to report about proceeds of unlawful activities, for instance a bank knows about something and doesn't report it, can get a fine or imprisonment term for up to 15 years. And then I refer again to the Sexual Offences and Children's Act, and the question is raised whether the bill should not be, again, should that not be a 5-year prison term? Then if we go on to, I try to deal with all the offences. A carrier who knowingly transports a victim of trafficking, that's clause 9, gets 5 years or 15 million rand. The question that arises is whether a prison sentence of 5 years is adequate if mere failure to report in other legislation is 5 years. I'm raising the question. Failure of a internet service provider to report abuse. Again, there's reference to the Sexual Offences Act and the Children's Act, but maybe we need to reconsider that as well, although 5 years for that might be adequate. The 10 years for conduct facilitating trafficking in persons, for example, leasing premises, it's 10 years in the bill and 30 years suggested by the NPA. The 10 years seems to be okay there. And the same applies for tampering with travel documents. Maybe the 10 years is okay. For using services of victims of trafficking, in the bill it's 15 years or 50 million rand. That for using services of victims of trafficking and debt bondage, the term of imprisonment would seem to be appropriate there. We can talk about the fines later. So those are that's the one issue that I picked up, particularly reporting, where it is 1 year in the bill, shouldn't it be 5 years, so that it links up with similar offences in other legislation. What the NPA has done as far as fines is concerned, it would seem to use, it benchmarks, it would seem, Section 3 of POCA, which relates to an offence for, the NPA seems to benchmark against POCA the offences under Chapter 3 of POCA. Those are the offences relating to proceeds of unlawful activities. That's money laundering, assisting another to benefit from proceeds of unlawful activities, acquisition, possession, or use of proceeds of unlawful activities. And for those offences, you can get 100 million rand or 30 years imprisonment. That's their highest offence, or that's the highest fine that they suggest. Elsewhere, the other fines that they've suggested, they seem to have used 1 year equals 3 million. 3 million rand. So for 5 years, you get 15 million, and so they go on. But 30 years doesn't equal 100 million, but it's close enough. At the end of our document, we raised the question, maybe just as a possible alternative, is to do what POCA does. They've got, they use 100 million or 30 years imprisonment for the offences I've just referred to. But for other, and then they've got 1,000 million or life imprisonment for racketeering. But the others, the other penalty, or the other offences in POCA, they refer to a fine or so many years imprisonment. And at the end of the day, I think the department is recommending that we go back to the bill as it was introduced. As the Sexual Offences Act does it, the Children's Act does it, the Child Justice Act does it, that we refer to a fine as against the number of years imprisonment and leave it to the discretion of the courts and their jurisdictional limits. The one exception that we might want to make is giving effect to the NPA's proposal is that the only fine that you might want to put in respect to the main offence, trafficking in persons, peg that at 100 million and a 30 or life imprisonment fine, a life imprisonment term, and then the rest you leave to the court's discretion and within their limits of jurisdiction. But pegging that one will give an indication to the courts where the others fit in.
Mr. Jeffrey and then Mr. Ambrosini.
Yeah, I mean, look, the unfortunate thing is we've only got this document now. However, from the previous discussion, we did have some quite extensive discussion last time. Looking at their document, and it's what Mr. Bassett has just said on page 27, the department is still of the view that the penalty provisions in the bill should not determine the maximum fines, but should leave this to the courts to deal with, as suggested in the introduced bill. My difficulty is that these are maximums. These are max. It's a sentencing. These are maximums. The court can give less. The maximums do give an indication of how seriously the legislature regards the offence. But usually, as Mr. Bassett says, it is to a fine or a sentence of imprisonment of no more than X number of years, and the years gives the indication. Okay. So I prefer, I must say, I mean, I don't know if we can finalize this now without having read the document and gone through it. I'm just skimming it now. But I prefer the issue of not providing for maximum fines, that you give the indication of the term of imprisonment, which gives an indication of the seriousness with which we regard the offense. Because otherwise it just becomes totally vague and arbitrary. I note that they have picked up a few cases where they're proposing, this is now from page 23, a longer maximum term of imprisonment. And I would say, well, if that is what, if that is consistent with other legislation, then let's be consistent, and it's more, it's heavier than what we're proposing. So it would be failure of the carrier to report. It's 1 year maximum. They're proposing up to five in lines with the Sexual Offences Act. So I would be in agreement with that. Mm-hmm. The same is there for also the carrying, the other carrier thing from 5 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. I think the rest is generally consistent. So I support the, but as I said, I don't know if we can finalise it. I support the proposal where we don't come with this later NPA argument, which I think is a bit off the wall, of putting all these fines in, and we then start getting extremely confused around what relates to what. That we give the indication to the courts about how serious we see the case in terms of the term of imprisonment, and that's what we've normally done. We leave it like that. On the trafficking thing, I mean, we've got to come to minimum sentences. And I can't remember to which minimum sentences apply. But the only thing, and I don't know whether the NPA thought about this, they've been plea bargaining almost all their cases, except the, what is it, Dos Santos, the last one. They've been pre-bargaining, which is very difficult for us, or anyone from the outside, to control. And I understand, is it Dos Santos, the last case? Yeah. I understand that Dos Santos, that some people in the NPA had wanted to pre-bargain that one too. But the prosecutor had gone ahead and won the case, luckily. I mean, well, not luckily, but won the case. If they had lost the case, obviously it would be a different perspective. And they then got life imprisonment. We don't want the NPA to take the shortcut of plea bargaining when they could win. But at the same time, we don't want a trafficker to walk when they could have actually been found guilty and been given at least a suspended sentence because the case is weak. So I think if we're going to have minimum sentences, because Mr. Bassett just raises it for the trafficking offence, have we considered that aspect enough? Because a minimum sentence is going to shut the door to plea bargaining. And plea bargaining may still be appropriate in certain cases. But Jeff, maybe that one could be cut out. What I'm really saying, as far as the item before us, I would support the idea that we don't determine the monetary amount of fines. We specify rather the maximum life term of imprisonment, and we do increase those two areas that Mr. Bassett has picked up.
And we leave it to the court's discretion, the fine.
Well, the whole thing is the court's discretion. Right. It's just a maximum, and I'm just saying a maximum fine, I think, just adds to confusion.
Okay. Mr. Swan?
Chair, the NPA argues that the Adjustments of Fines Act has not kept up with the requirements adequate, and they then set out a number of pieces of legislation that specify fines, such as the National Environmental Management Act, fines of 5 to 10 million, the Marine Living Resources Act, fines of 5 million, and then POCA, as Honourable Jeffries, the Environmental Conservation Act, fines of 5 to 10 million, Precious Metals Act, Protection of Constitutional Democracy, 100 million, Financial Intelligence Centre Act, fine up to 100 million. Now, I would support Honourable Jeffries with the later section, with the later provisions. But on 4.1 and 4.2, the trafficking, I would like us to set out the sentence provisions, the fine, so that it gives a court the maximum fine. And then later we could set out the years as well. So that at the upfront, 100 million together with the fine, and we can look at the issue of minimum sentences. But it seems the legislature is moving to set out fines, giving the figure, because of the Adjustments of Fines Act, which links, if you just put years, it seems that the years as translated is not keeping up, and maybe one needs to look at that, amending that act as well. So, audience, just because I think that I support the department to say up for under 13.1, that's 4.1 and 4.2, let's leave the 100 million and then we can take it down, because then at least gives the courts, this is what we are thinking. Thank you, Chair, because it's equating it to life imprisonment, remember. The other POCA talks about 30 years imprisonment and 100 million. Or 1,000 million even. 1,000 million.
It's a billion.
It's a billion. We're saying life imprisonment, 100 million. And I think we should put that figure just for, at the very least, for 13A.
Honourable Debbie Schaefer.
I think if we could finalise this next time, I would appreciate it, given that we haven't had a chance to completely read the document. I mean, I agree in principle that I don't think we should be specifying too many things, because I do think it should be up to the court. And I mean, if you're having a trafficking syndicate, I mean, maybe even 100 million is pocket money for them, you never know. I mean, the court should be able to decide based on the facts of the case. But yeah, I mean, I do think we need to give an indication of. I do support the idea of giving a sentence, at least for the main offence. But if we could maybe just leave it for complete finalisation next time, if that's in order.
We are not going to go beyond 1 o'clock. Okay. Mr. Bassett,
thank you very much. I can.
Oh, just I'm sorry, Mr. Ambrosini. My apologies.
Thank you. You're a fair chairman. I have a couple of difficulties, and I don't know, Mr. Chairman, whether there are personal difficulties. The NPA is part of the Department of Justice broader family, and we approve their budget, etc. So they have a special relationship with this committee. But I'm wondering whether I or we, as legislators, the extent to which we should listen in determining legislators. Yes, what did I say? Sorry. The extent to which we should listen or pay deference to the law enforcers. And these are the policemen. They want to put people in jail. That's what their job is. And put them in jail for as long as possible on the notion that they, if they're out of sight, they will not do it again. Under the Constitution, the principle of punishment is that of rehabilitation. That's why we punish people. And that's one concern. I mean, do we need to pay total deference, or should we look at this with a grain of salt? The second concern I have, as hideous as these crimes are, as I understand them, and my understanding might be limited, they happen in situation of, in the underworld. These are not big financial crimes. These are not Wall Street crimes. So we're talking about hundreds of millions, billions. The tragic, horrendous reality is that human beings are low added value commodities. These, they are trafficked as dehumanized, but that part of the humanization relates also to their value. So those figures, I'm not sure whether they fit the context of the crime we're dealing with. The third concern I have, and I want to make sure that I understand correctly, because at times my understanding is limited. But if I look, yes, and but if I look at GNF, I mean, with G, you get a guy who is not a public official, is not a businessman, is not somebody with trade and commerce, is not somebody who's got special duty or diligence, is your run-of-the-mill citizen, could be in leading communities, etc., who goes to jail for 5 years, or it can be subjected to 15 million rands for failure to report a suspicion she may have, that a young girl might have been forced to enter into a marriage against her will. So I look at this, yeah, it's the failure to report to the police a suspicion. And if that girl happens to be 18 years or older, it goes down to 3 million and 1 year in jail. So adequacy. It seems that horrified as we rightly should be on the nature of the crime, we might have lost perspective, and everyone who gets involved in it, irrespective of the materiality of what they do, seems to be tarnished with the same brush which has painted these very draconian fines and imprisonments.
But of course the court does have a discretion. Alright, Mr. Bassett. I think the members want time to go through your documents.
Okay, can I just mention, I did discuss the department's proposal, the one that we're saying, let's just peg the main offence and leave the rest, mention fine. And I spoke to Mr. Noel, and he said that the NPA could look with something like that as well. So I don't think they will fight and kick and scream if we do away with all the penalties that they've suggested, as long as they have that benchmark at the top.
All right. Good.
Sounds good. I like that benchmark, because just pointed out now, the Adjustments of Fines Act says 1 year is 20,000 rand. We've got to put in that figure. It's absolutely, and we've got to amend that act as well. We need to relook at that act. But that's a separate issue.
Yeah, it's a separate issue, please.
I don't think we should be putting too much reliance on the Adjustment of Fines Act. That is a useful ratio that only applies in the district courts. I found to my shock the other day, if you read the Adjustment of Fines Act, is really only intended, it's only mandatory in the district courts. It does give guidance, and I think it is used, but I do agree that it needs to be...
If we don't put in an amount... then it would give guidance to the High Court sentencing.
It does, it can give guidance, but it's not, yeah.
I would rather see us amending
the Adjustments of Fine Act than doing a piecemeal approach in this legislation.
All right. Honourable members, on that note, Mr. Bassett, I want to thank you and your team. We've had a very good session this morning. I want to call it to an end. Monani, we want them back next week, Tuesday. Is that okay with you? We bring Home Affairs, the authorized version. I couldn't resist saying that. No. Mr. Ambrosini. I'm still speaking. So we will endeavor to ensure that Home Affairs are here with you. But as I said, it must be the person who's authorized to speak. It's no good having somebody here and they, at every turn, they say, well, I'll have to go back to my principles. That's not going to work for us. All right, Mr. Jeffrey.
Look, I think we've got another morning session to finish the rest of the bill, so even if Home Affairs can't come next week,
we can still proceed.
But maybe we need 2 days next week, because Home Affairs would be one day, but we need if Home Affairs come, or when they come, we need the Hawks and we need the NPA present. To not have them present is just going to mean we're going to have to then refer and involve them later, and it would be a waste of time.
Fair enough. Okay. So, my thanks to you. I want to address, it's a pity that certain people have left.
Certain members of the committee have said they'll report back.
Well, okay. Honourable members, you'll recall that on the eve of the World Cup kickoff, you made your position very clear on this bill. I clearly recall the Honourable Debbie Schaefer saying, we are not prepared to legislate for FIFA. Yes. And you did that with good reason. And subsequent events proved you correct, because the tens of thousands of traffic victims that were going to enter the country didn't. In fact, when we asked the authorities to provide us with a figure, my recollection is that it was in the region of zero?
Zero.
Well, okay. Now, during the recent recess, a journalist by the name of Zara Nicholson, that's not you, eh?
No.
She's a journalist with the Cape Times, called me in a state, telling me that she was doing a series of articles dealing with trafficking, and that she had a deadline of the following day, the Wednesday, at 12 noon. Could I please send her a report? Which I did. And I think I emailed all of you copies of that. A week later, she called me again, and again she was in a state, saying that the following day was her deadline. And could I please tell her the program relating to the trafficking bill? And I then said to her, no. Including, what date will the committee finalize the bill? I pointed out to her, I said, you know, legislating is not like bookkeeping. If I give a bookkeeper a set of books and asked him or her to give me a deadline, they would do so. They would say, Friday morning at 9 o'clock, I will present you with these books. Legislating is not like bookkeeping. It's a whole different process. And I pointed this out to her. Aside from that, I'm not aware, but I don't live in Cape Town, so I haven't been able to follow whether my report to her and the articles she said she was writing have appeared or carried in the Cape Times. Now, to the memorandum that was handed to me. Firstly, they say, they speak of the US Department, State Department's report. I'm not aware of such a report. I'd love to have a copy of it. Firstly. Secondly, it's a bit rich coming from America, who has Abu Ghraib, and presently
they have a detention facility in Poland run by the Polish government where they detain people who are supposedly involved in terrorism. Now, is rendition of alleged terrorists not a form of trafficking? I ask the question. So I'm not impressed by the US State Department telling us how we should conduct our matters. They say, amongst other things, that South Africa is a source, transit, and destination country for men, women, and children subject to forced labor and sex trafficking. That may be true. And then they go on further to say that our legislation results in those convicted receiving suspended sentences or fines. That's gross coming from America. Well, if it is true, it's gross. Now, it is also unconstitutional to expect the President and Minister Khadebe, the Minister of Justice, to demand of this committee that we approve the bill. That would fall foul of the Constitution. But this memorandum calls on them to prioritize and ensure its rapid passage and immediate signing into law. Yes, there may seem to be an undue delay, but again, this is legislating. We're not bookkeeping. It is also not true that there is a lack of comprehensive legislation dealing with human trafficking. We've been over this. At great pains, the NPA pointed out to us that they are able to prosecute people responsible for trafficking. And they gave us examples of those. So, that is as far as that is concerned. I just think I need to make this point. It would be irresponsible and a dereliction of our duty for this committee to hastily rush to pass this bill without ensuring that it is workable and implementable. Those are the key issues. All of you know this. The question that's always in our mind is this workable? Is it implementable? And so simply rushing to speedily approve the bill doesn't serve anybody's purposes. We're not saying that we don't care about victims of trafficking. We do. One victim of trafficking is one victim too many. But we do have a responsibility. And I think people need to take cognizance of that. Honorable members, I'll make copies of this memorandum for you, but I sincerely hope that the organizations listed here take careful note of these matters. Mr. Jeffrey and then Mr. Ambrosini.
The Chair, I agree. The reference to the suspended sentences, I mean, that has been what is happening. That has been because of the criminal process of the legislation. And I mean, this issue you'd be raising now, the only way one's going to stop these suspended sentences is if one outlaws plea bargaining, which I don't think is trafficking, which I don't think is appropriate. It's completely wrong. But I mean, the facts are from the information the NPA gave us that up until Dos Santos, everybody was getting suspended sentences. Because they would keep up in cases, because presumably the NPA was worried about their chances of success.
Okay.
But that's not because of the law, that's because of how they approached it and things. And they do go ahead with Dos Santos and get life.
Okay. Mr. Ambrosini.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You, Mr. Chairman, have made a statement from the chair. As the chair of this committee, I happen to agree 100% to everything I said. You said, no, especially. But I think it would be important for that statement not to be just a statement from the chair. And I would like to formally move that the committee endorses your statement, Mr. Chairman.
Well, okay, Debbie.
Yeah, I'm also concerned that at the ongoing statements that there is no legislation to deal with trafficking, when this clearly isn't the case. And I've certainly made that point before in statements also. There's usually organized crime. It's poker is involved. There's a sexual trafficking provision in the Sexual Offences Act. And to keep on saying that there is nothing in place is a misrepresentation of the truth as well.
True. Very true.
No, I
agree with 99% of what you've said.
Which is the 1%.
But I think that there are issues, there are genuine concerns about delays, and it's not due to our fault. But I am concerned about the ongoing issue that I've expressed with Home Affairs. We've raised this issue. I checked my notes in August and in September, and now again, it's open-ended. So I think there is merit in concerns about the delays. I fully appreciate, and I've come to, in listening to the deliberations, understanding the concerns about the abuse of the legislation. So I'm fully aware of the need to look at it very carefully. Just on the wording of the comprehensive legislation, I think that is referred to by the department, and the need that we need comprehensive legislation that deals with victims, which we don't deal with anywhere else. And I think that is where the miscommunication comes in, particularly with the emails that say there isn't legislation. They don't understand there is sufficient legislation for prosecution, but there's not legislation dealing with the victims. And most of those organizations deal with victims, and I think that is the concern. So just with that slight caveat, I do support what you said. Thank you, Chair.
All right. At some other stage, I will refer to the whole question of donor funding.
Yeah.
Which I've deliberately stayed silent on, but at some point we'll address that, because I often wonder whether the concerns are real and directed at the victims themselves, or whether they're not really concerned about the possible loss of donor funding. But that's another issue. Thank you very much. Yeah.